being a lone Himalayan explorer.
Is there danger from human beings out there sometimes when you're exploring?
Sometimes you also get picked up by a guy with an AK-47, so you have to be careful in JNK.
Being in snow is not as simple as
it looks.
It looks on Cartoon Network.
Sometimes I think it has been like you just pitch up your tent and immediately you see the frost forming on the inside of the sheet of the tent, like some minus 20.
What's the most beautiful place you've seen in India?
These nomadic tribes, Bakarwals, shepherds.
Bakarwal tribals are in Kashmir.
These kids just have actually nothing, but the smiles you see there.
Wow, look at that kid. Never had a fall or anything?
But this was a case where we were crossing like a mountain stream, so with leopard to attack, he suddenly saw us.
I'm saying this as a compliment, but you're a bit of a psycho. The question that's ringing in my head is about yetis.
I think I've also seen similar things. It looks like a bigger footprint in the snow.
YouTube is filled with countless podcasts where you learn about how to do better in your career, how to do better in your relationships, how to do better in terms of mental health. Not many podcasts will teach you about how to go about exploration better. Not many listeners of this particular episode are going to go out after this episode and begin to explore the Himalayas. But what I hope that this episode brings you is perspective, because that's what these kind of guests bring to my mind and heart. Peter Van Geet was born and raised in Belgium. Life brought him to India. And then within India, he's gone on his own exploration journeys specific to the Himalayas. He's a man who literally just takes off and explores the Himalaya on foot by himself, completely alone. There's days where he covers 40 to 50 kilometers in one single stretch. This is not a normal human being in my eyes. At least it's not something you hear of commonly in India. So this is a very perspective building podcast. There is something that will shift within you. You will look at life differently if you give this whole podcast a listen and let it sink into your soul. This is Peter Van Geet on TRS. Peter Van Geet, welcome to TRS. I've been speaking to you for the last 3 years.
Yeah, I think so.
But we're finally here.
Yeah, finally. Good to be here, Ranveer.
Good to have you in our studio.
Yeah.
I can talk to you openly now that the cameras are rolling.
Correct.
How are you?
Yeah, doing good. Just came from Chennai, my home base, for the last 25 years that I've been in India. Short break from my usual Himalayan journeys in the north.
What did you do before you came to Chennai?
I'm basically from Belgium. I was born and raised there, finished my master's of computer science. And then in 98, so 25 years ago, I was sent to India, recruit a small team of software engineers to write software. I've been working as a project manager in Cisco, the network giant, for the last 20 years almost, before quitting the job in 2017 and then becoming more of a lone Himalayan explorer.
A lone Himalayan explorer.
Yeah.
As in you actually go out for solo expeditions alone.
Yeah, I mostly go solo. So I go for like month-long journeys across the most remote corners of the Himalayas. I'm pretty good with map reading and navigation. So I use these old Survey of India maps to find very remote trails. And those are really amazing journeys. Going solo is like a meditative experience. It's just you and Mother Nature. Untouched by human hand, you come across like mountain tribes, shepherds, and beautiful untouched nature. Actually, it's an amazing journey, full of adventure and peacefulness, I would say.
We don't see too many Indians who think that way in terms of just heading out into the Himalayas alone.
Yeah,
I've seen lots of people who head out in groups.
Correct.
You know, head out for purposes. I don't think I've met anyone who goes out alone, because I think being Indian is about being in a community.
I guess so, yeah.
So I'm very excited about this conversation. I can't imagine everything that you've seen out there.
Yeah.
What's the most beautiful place you've seen in India?
Yeah, so I mean, the Indian Himalayas are really amazing. So you go, so I'm used to living in Chennai at sea level, but there you go up till 5,000 meters. You get these beautiful snow-covered glaciers. Himalayas are very seasonal, right? The monsoon, the summer, the winter is quite different. And so I've actually started a large hiking group in Chennai called the Chennai Trekking Club for a decade. So that was founded in 2008. That thing grew pretty big to some 40,000 people. It was like a non-profit volunteer-based organization.
40,000 people?
40,000 people, yeah. We did a lot of outdoor sports, triathlons, marathons, ultra runs, a lot of environmental activities, social activities. So that went on for a decade. But then in recent years, it has been nice to step out of this group and kind of more get into like long solo journeys. As you were a little bit older, you kind of feel at ease just on your own. And seeing some of the really beautiful high altitude nature out there, like glaciers and moraines, leopards, bears, and all those things.
Do you get happier as you age?
I think you get more experience, you get more wiser. I'm 52 now. I still feel I haven't reached the peak of my mental and physical endurance. I still ran 170 kilometers last week from Chennai to Auroville to attend the marathon. So I'm still feeling pretty good at this age.
You think you're getting physically better?
Yeah, I think physically you're getting stronger. So it's not about sprint, right? You might be good as a sprinter in your 20s and 30s, but when you or older, you become better at endurance. When you want to push, like say, run ultra races for like 40 hours, 2 days, two nights, nonstop running, you're much more stronger, your body, after a couple of decades. And also your mental endurance is so much stronger than somebody half of your age.
You know, the older I get, the more I realize how much physical health matters. And yeah. I started playing a lot of football again recently.
Okay.
And I started getting these very bad injuries. I got this horrible groin injury because of which I couldn't play anymore. And then that made me think that, my body's deteriorating. I've turned 30. And I used to cry to my friends about it. I used to cry on the show about it. And then eventually I met someone who said that eventually your body becomes what your mind wants it to become as long as you're putting in the work. So tell that injury to heal. Tell yourself that you're getting stronger and tell yourself that you're still going to reach the ultimate version of yourself.
Yeah, correct. I think after a certain push, after a certain amount of endurance, it's more of a mental thing than a physical thing. Physics is important. You need to get in a regular fitness routine. But I think the mind can push the body to do a lot that you would think is not possible.
Has your life ever been in danger?
A couple of times when you get lost in the Himalayas, it tends to be risky that you end up, you lose the trail, you get lost, you try to make your move forward, and then you end up with little fingertips hanging on rocks, coming down a vertical rock face, trying to get back onto a proper trail where you... So it has been a couple of occasions that actually you feel the heartbeat in your throat as you hang like 50 meters above an almost vertical cliff. So... Yeah, and the weather can also be threatening. As you go higher to 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 meters, the weather becomes more volatile and more life-threatening sometimes in case it turns bad.
I want to hear about this story in detail. Tell me about both the stories. Start with the first one.
Yeah, so I mean, I've done like around 10,000 kilometers now, I think, over the last couple of years since I quit the job across the Himalayas. I've done a lot of mapping work also.
10,000 kilometers on foot?
On foot, yeah. So, and this is like pretty rough terrain. It's not like walking along the Marine Drive in Mumbai. It's like over big rocks and moraines and scree and sinking in snow till your waist. So it's pretty intense. You burn a lot of calories.
I'm saying this as a compliment, but you're a bit of a psycho.
I could be a bit more of a survivor and taking it extreme. And all of that I do pretty minimalist. So I just carry some 4 or 5 kg on my back, very lightweight tent. Like a bivy sack in which I sleep at night, small sleeping bag. I usually only carry a t-shirt and shorts. I just keep rinsing myself in the streams. So going lightweight is important because you have to go over a significant terrain, like very steep terrain, a lot of climbing. Like last big hike was in Uttarakhand, 4 months. I did some 2,000 kilometers, which is fine, but more than 2,000 kilometers, it's your vertical climb. I did some 1.2 lakhs vertical elevation gain, which is like 18 times the height of Mount Everest. So that you really feel in your quads and your calves. Something.
In a day, usually on an average, how far do you walk?
I try to kind of maximize my use of the day. So I wake up usually when the sunlight hits my tents, which means like 6-7 o'clock in the morning. And I usually walk for 12 hours till the sun sets. Then it becomes really cold. So by 6-7 o'clock, I try to find a suitable campsite close to water, flat place where I can pitch up my tent. And so every day it's like for months altogether, 12 hours of steady walking. And it's not usually a trail. As an explorer, actually, you go through a lot of rough terrain, like scree, loose rocks, climbing on some vertical rocks to a mountain pass over long glaciers, so permanent ice sheets for kilometers and kilometers. Sometimes in the winter, you sink in the snow that everything is blanked out. You don't see the trails anymore. So then you need to be more experienced on navigation that you don't lose the way.
I mean, usually I think, so there's a couple of things. Most people don't understand what even walking for 10 kilometers actually feels like.
Yeah.
I've done a 100 kilometer kind of race thing once.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And my hips blew out, my knees were destroyed, and I was just 23 years old that time. And that's when I understood what 100 kilometers is as a distance as well.
Yeah.
And we did it in 36 hours. Every 10 kilometers after the 50 kilometer mark felt easy. But before the 50 kilometer mark, every 10 kilometers was very, very long. And that's when I realized that even 10 kilometers is much longer than most people would think.
Correct. Yeah.
Which is why I ask you this question. In terms of roughly in kilometers, how much do you walk in 12 hours, roughly? I'm not trying to gauge your speed.
On a day, so it all depends on the terrain, Ranveer. Sometimes in Ladakh, where the terrain is open and gradual, you can actually do 40, 50 kilometers in a single day.
Wow.
You cannot run because high altitude, you have 50% of the oxygen compared to sea level. Plus, you're carrying a shelter and a bag and food on your back. But sometimes it's just like 15 kilometers in a day because you're hanging on some rock face, you're scrambling through thorns and bushes. Bad weather is there, so it's like a snow blizzard in your face at high altitudes. So it all depends on the terrain and the weather, actually, how much distance you can cover. But at the end of the day, it's all the same. Whether it's 15 or 50 kilometers, you would have burned some 7,000-8,000 calories in a single day.
How do you replenish 7,000-8,000 calories?
A lot of, local organic homegrown food, actually. The food you get served by locals, like the shepherds, they have these thick rotis. Two of those thick rotis are enough. They also put a lot of ghee, a lot of fat, I guess, on the sabji that you eat. And then if you get a cup of tea from freshly milked from the mountain goat who has been grazing these snow-fed alpine meadows, there is so much of nutrition in this natural food that it quickly replenishes you and that you feel again okay to proceed the next day.
How do all these experiences change your mind and your heart as you go forward in life?
Yeah, one thing that I've seen is 50% of me is about natural beauty that you encounter in the middle of nowhere. It's about meditation and peace. But 50% of it is also like the people you encounter. So these remote tribes, these nomadic tribes, Bakarwals, shepherds, people who live like in mud houses and no electricity, no road, no mobile internet. So they don't have any facilities there. People just live there with their buffaloes or sheep in the middle of a jungle. So if you spend time with these people, then you can actually appreciate like humanity more. So these people are very innocent, very helpful. They will give you warm hospitality. In many cases, I end up sometimes sleeping in their bed while they sleep on the floor next to me. So one thing I learned is that people who have very less materialistically, they have like a big heart. They are like so amazing. And it's nice to experience and see that humanity and much of it, which we have lost in the city, because in the city, it's all about a self-enrichment. We are running behind money all the time. We are stressed. People there really have like a pure soul and really help each other.
That's the raw format of being a human being.
Correct.
Yeah. We're not living in the raw format anymore.
No, I think there's too many distractions and too many different priorities here compared to the people that are living amongst themselves in nature, just surviving in very basic ways.
How do you communicate with them?
Yeah, so I'm not much of a language person. My main base was Chennai. Chennai is just English and Tamil, not even Hindi, as you know. So I'm not too much. So I know the basics for guidance, food and shelter in Hindi.
You just say khana.
Khana, yeah, or have some pani or some chai or whatever.
Do you pay them?
No, actually, I don't think they would appreciate it. They actually don't use money over there also. So people don't, they use have Google Pay or cash. Even the shepherds, when they go for a bag of rice to the village nearby, so they stay there up for sometimes 4 or 5 months with their herd grazing. So they need to eat rotis, tawa, atta, flour and rice. So I think they also work more in an exchange way, like the old days. So
barter system.
Yeah, they give maybe one sheep and then they get 5 bags of rice in return.
Damn.
So there's no money use over there. Yeah, these are the people that I meet, actually. You can see some of the rough-looking tribals there. These are the typical people you find in Jammu and Kashmir. I've stayed with them. They're like, they look a little rough, right? Because they live in the wild. They live in pretty harsh conditions sometimes. But they are really, I mean, people the size of their heart, you will not find anyone in the city here.
Can you pull up? So Bakarwal tribals are in Kashmir.
Yeah, you can see Kashmiri Bakarwals. I think a large percentage of the population in Kashmir are actually nomadic tribes. So these are the people indeed you meet, like very, very nice people. They have very less. Kids will not go to schools. Kids will just pick up the profession of that. And they go there with the whole family. They will have some horses carrying their blankets and cooking gears. The women will take care of the kids and the campsite. And then the men will go out grazing in the surrounding meadows. The buffaloes or the sheep or the whatever cattle they take along with them. I can tell you, spend one night with these people and it'll change your life.
How?
Yeah, I mean, their simplicity, their innocence, their niceness, their humanity. Their soul has not been disturbed in any way by the modern day things in the cities, I would say, like the materialism, the money, and yeah.
Do the kids think differently than the adults?
Yeah, so again, I don't master Hindi too well, so I'm not able to have a deep conversation with them. But they live very simple. I mean, kids, even sheep get born there. They get put on the horse and the family, and both the human family and the animals expand as they sometimes come from pretty far. Some of these people come from the plains and go all the way to the Himalayas over hundreds of kilometers with the whole family. Imagine. Then they stay there the whole summer. And then when the winter snow comes in by this September, they come back to the plains.
Have you ever eaten mutton?
Yeah, I mean, mutton is there. Most of the people you meet there are actually vegetarians. So
really?
Yeah. So they will only, maybe you'll only get mutton if one of the sheep dies. Some of the sheep really die because of extreme weather. And also some of the mountain passes they have to cross on the way to those meadows, those alpine meadows, are like very treacherous. So I met a shepherd once. He had 700 sheep. In one season, usually around 50 sheep die because of extreme weather. Very steep and rocky terrain, so rocks fall down, sheep gets washed away in streams, wild streams, predators, like I was saying, nocturnal predators like leopards will pick up a small goatee from the herd. So imagine like 10% kind of does not make it back alive at the end of the summer.
But these guys are mainly vegetarian?
I think so. Most of the people, okay, God, these are the family that I stayed with last year somewhere in Jammu. Very
wow.
Nice people. I mean, it's like amazing. You can see all smiling faces, right?
Zoom in on the faces?
Very less, but the smiles you see there,
wow, look
is
like kid.
Much more than the spoiled little kids in the city here, which have the Sony PlayStations and YouTube. These kids are just have actually nothing. They have an old dress. It'll all be stained there because they cannot wash their clothes also. And they're very happy. I think it has to do with the fact that they are still like strongly connected with their natural surroundings and that they have not been diverted in the modern day distractions, I guess.
The younger kid is so happy that you're taking his photo.
Yeah, I guess so.
Older kid is a little suspicious.
Yeah, that white guy. What is he doing here? Yeah, we are in Jammu and Kashmir, so they have a bit of a political history. Sometimes you also get picked up by a guy with an AK-47, so you have to be careful in JNK.
Fun!
Yeah, we had experiences that, like in 2022, I think, me and another guy from Chennai, a bit of a tall guy with a long beard, we were hiking somewhere.
Indian guy?
Yeah, Indian guy from Chennai. But he looks a little like a bit of a bearded guy. And so in one place, we are just walking. And then, JNK has a bit of a political history, right? So then one local police guy armed with an AK-47, he told us, stop, because he sees we are outsiders. The faces are different than the locals. And then when my buddy, they said, put down your bags. You might carry some arms or anything in his understanding. Then when my buddy tried to open his bag, he got like worried that we would set off some explosive or so. And he raised his gun and it was a bit tense. But then once they know that you're really there, say, as just a nature lover, hiker or so, then at the end of the day, actually, we eventually end up in staying with the family of the local commissioner of police or somebody like that and getting amazing hospitality again. The people are very nice, but sometimes I guess it's the troubled history that makes them a little nervous when they see an outsider.
Have you actually met terrorists as well?
No. So my focus has been till, I would say, Jammu. I haven't really gone to the sensitive border areas.
Okay. But this incident happened in Jammu?
Yeah, this was in Jammu somewhere, in Dola district.
Is there danger from human beings out there sometimes when you're exploring?
I don't really think so. Again, as I told, most of the people that roam there are nomads or like mountain tribes, locals. I don't think like that. I mean, terrorists, okay, in the border areas are there, but I don't think the criminals kind of hide in those specific areas. So the locals you encounter are, as I already told, very nice, very innocent, very helpful, because they understand you're an outsider, you're trying to find your way in a very difficult region. So human beings compared to the human beings that I usually sometimes met in the big metros, it's like very safe and very, very helpful. Mm. The more remote, the more humane and the more helpful they'll be. Mm. Not human beings, I would also not say wildlife. Your most potent enemy would be the weather. The weather, when it turns bad, like you get into a snowstorm, you get into bad rain and wind. Here it's fun to go on a monsoon trek in the Sahyadris, but if you get stuck there in bad weather, it's a totally different story because it's like minus 10, minus 20, snow is hitting your face, it's like freezing. So shelter and being safe against the nature's fury at high altitude is important.
So if it starts raining there, the rain immediately turns into snow, hits your face, burns it up a little bit.
Yeah, you have to be careful when the weather turns bad, because at 5,000 meter, you're extremely exposed. I mean, it's like turning the dial D. You have to amplify the impact of the weather as you go higher and higher. A lot of people die, actually, mountaineers, when they hang on these, when they climb those peaks, because they are exposed and they're hanging on a rope, they can't get away. I usually try to keep myself safe by keeping my feet on the trails. So in case the weather turns bad, you can quickly come down to lower altitude, find like a rock or a cave or something where you can shelter for a day or two until the weather turns good again.
So that's a mechanism to safeguard your body.
Yeah.
Like that you try staying on the main trail rather than going off trail.
Yeah. So I'm more of a hiker. I'm not really a mountaineer who climbs peaks, right? So mountaineering is also pretty popular amongst the youngsters. I'm more of an explorer who kind of stays on the trail. I just cross mountain passes that connect one valley to the next valley. But if there is an issue that the weather turns bad quickly, you can kind of quickly come down via the trail to a lower altitude where the impact, the strength of the bad weather will be less. Find a shelter, like a rock shelter, and sit out the bad weather until it becomes safe again to venture out.
Are you able to predict when the weather is going to get bad?
It's difficult. As you go higher, the weather becomes more volatile. Like so where
randomly, quickly things
can change. You have those snow-covered peaks, right? And then as the sun rises during the day, it gets hotter. There is some kind of interference that happens there between the planet and the skies. And it quickly changes, especially in summer when the sun is hot. winter is more stable on the weather, so then you can go through snow-covered landscape.
Winter is more stable.
It's more stable, yeah. There will be less, because there is less heat, I think. It's mostly the heat and the evaporation of the moist in the forest that causes a lot of turbulence at higher altitude. So nothing like a couple of months walking in the snow in winter with a blue sky, which is a beautiful contrast with the white snow, knowing that mostly it'll be pretty stable the winter.
What's the coldest you felt on one of these expeditions?
It all depends. Like sometimes you, usually you try to camp a little bit in the valley at lower altitude, but sometimes to capture that beautiful sunset or sunrise, you try to camp on top of a peak. Where you're fully exposed at 360 degrees, you're camping in frozen snow. Sometimes I think it has been like you just pitch up your tent and immediately you see the frost forming on the inside of the sheet of the tent, like some minus 20 or so. And then you need a good like sleeping bag, like a minus 12, minus 15 degree sleeping bag to keep yourself warm. Daytime is okay. I usually go in shorts. I will even sink in snow in shorts. I will go through wild streams in shorts because you keep moving around here. So your body generates a lot of internal heat. But as soon as you pitch up your tent at the end of the night, the sun disappears behind the mountain. The temperature will drop from, say, 20 degrees to minus 10. And you really need to keep yourself warm and until the sun rises up again the next morning.
So recently I went to Gulmarg in Kashmir.
Okay.
Okay. The way to go to Gulmarg is you go to Srinagar first and then you drive up to Gulmarg. So I went to Srinagar on the 3rd and my family was supposed to arrive on the 4th.
Yeah.
But it started snowing so much in Srinagar that my family couldn't make it to Srinagar.
Yeah.
So I was kind of stuck in Srinagar alone.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, it's fine. Let me go and explore Gulmarg. When I went to Gulmarg, I realized it's a bit of a ski town. Like people go there to ski, to snowboard.
Yeah.
Even the hotel I was at, Shaw Inn, to get out of that hotel, you had to be careful not to slip in the snow. It wasn't simple to walk in the snow. And this was the first time I was experiencing that depth of snow.
Yeah.
On the way to Gulmarg, they make you stop at a rental place and
get these suits, I guess.
Yeah. Buy those big jackets, which I understand. I thought, okay, it must be much colder up there. That's fine.
Yeah.
But they also make you buy these tall boots.
Okay.
And that was a new thing for me because I've never experienced that height of snow.
Yeah.
Then the moment you reach Gulmarg, you see all the snow around you. So your first instinct is, hey, I want to run in the snow. So I started running in the snow. But because it was so deep, some of the snow entered the tall boot.
And it starts melting.
Yeah. And then you realize, oh, my foot is feeling a little numb. And then I realize, okay, that's why the tall boots exist in the first place.
Yeah.
If you try just wearing sneakers or something like that, even if the snow doesn't enter your sneakers, what ends up happening is that the sneaker becomes cold from underneath and the cold starts coming in from underneath.
Correct, correct.
So walking around and just being in snow is not as simple as... It looks on Cartoon Network. It's a little more complex.
Yeah, correct, correct.
And my first thought in Gulmarg was good that my family didn't get this flight because there's a, you know, 2-year-old child.
Okay.
My sister's also not very big on like exploration and all that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're homebodies.
Yeah.
So that was my first thought. But my second thought was, wow, let's explore this. Like, this is fun, but you need to know how to go through snow.
Yeah, correct.
The reason I'm bringing this up is I walked in about minus 14 degree temperature. I did a 30 minute hike from one hotel to another at 1 a.m., 2 a.m.
In the night.
Yeah, and they say that there are leopards and bears in the Gulmarg territory. It's relatively safe, but I was scared. I was cold, but I was at peace. I was enjoying myself. Some dogs were walking with me. It was fun. I can't imagine what it's like on the top of a peak.
Yeah, it gets more, and sometimes you get like 30, 50 feet snow deposit in winter, which gets compacted into ice. And you can see that when you then explore in the next summer, you have these big ice bridges, snow bridges, kind of, they call it, over the stream. So where they still exist at the beginning of the summer. So it's like massive, yeah. And snow is fun. Snow is usually a bit soft. You get a grip. But then the next morning when the snow is frozen, and if you combine frozen snow, which is hard and slippery, with like a steep trail, then it becomes quite tricky sometimes.
Dangerous.
Yeah. Because you don't get grip on that anymore. You need like an ice axe sometimes to cut your way through those steep frozen snow gullies on the way to the mountain pass to the peak.
Have you come close to meeting a bear?
Yeah, a couple of times, both in South as well as in the Himalayas, like a black bear. Again, in Uttarakhand, a pretty wild place. So usually bears will keep their distance. They will not really come for you. But this was a case where we were crossing like a mountain stream. So it was a bit noisy. I guess the bear didn't hear us coming. And then we were climbing up on a small plateau. And there the bear, I guess, was eating some berries. He suddenly saw us, not too big. I think it was like a younger animal. And as soon as he saw us, actually, he kind of moved away.
Still capable of taking your guts out.
Yeah, definitely. In South India, for example, near Tirupati, the Venkateswara National Reserve Forest, there we came face to face with a big one, like a, more like a brown one bear. And that guy was actually looking at us. So I guess he saw us coming. He was not afraid because he's pretty big and we were like small human beings. So there we obviously best thing to do is not to run away because then he might think, okay, let me just run behind them and catch them. So we kept holding ground. We remained calm. I told my guys, stay calm. We'll just see. And we were looking at each other. We were staring in each other's eyes for about 30 seconds.
30 seconds?
Yeah. So he was thinking what to do. Is this a threat to me or is this, could this be a prey for me? And finally, then he decided to walk away. I don't know why. Maybe we didn't wash ourselves for almost 9 days that time. So maybe the smell of the human. But that, yeah, sometimes a bit tense. But I think you need to remain calm. You cannot appear offensive. Also, you should not appear frightful towards animals. Then they might know, okay, this guy is scared of me. And they might come after you.
You know, I think that's what people don't understand about wild animals.
We call them wild, but I think people are much more wild than the animals. We are the ones who have exterminated much of the,
we're the most
biodiversity.
We're the most dangerous animal
exactly.
out there.
Exactly. So it's easy to call them wildlife. I think we call them wildlife because we have become so disconnected from the nature, from the natural habitat. Mm. And we have so locked up in our concrete city that we kind of lost touch with the wild. Look at the muscle of these animals.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, I mean, I meant to say undomesticated. The thing is with deer or even with Indian goats, these things can easily kill you though. Like physically speaking.
Yeah.
If you go too close or do something. But that's not what a lot of people assume until you've actually been to national parks yourself and seen the size of these things.
Yeah.
Nilgai, all these things are, it can be dangerous to go up close to it.
Yeah. Indeed.
Seen any snow leopards?
No, not snow leopards. Only the regular, the orange one, snow leopards. I think 100 snow leopards would have seen me, but I haven't seen them. Unfortunately, that's very elusive.
Plus, your eye can't catch them easily.
Yeah, right? I've seen like those ibexes, mountain goats. They run on these vertical rock slopes. It's amazing. Then you have rocks coming down. So even spotting those goats, they are so well camouflaged, Ranveer. It's very difficult to spot them in their natural habitat.
Have you seen any of them falling off?
They are like masters of those vertical rock faces. It's amazing how they simply run up and they run, right? They don't climb. They run up a vertical rock face that you think, how is it even possible? But I guess, yeah, they are the prey of these leopards. So they need to be very agile and very speedy in these steep terrains actually to survive, obviously. I've seen dead carcasses, like goats who have been killed probably by leopards and whatever is left over then.
That leopard's body that you saw, you know, the one with the flies in its eyes.
Yeah.
It was completely dead, right?
Yeah, it was a recent thing. So I took the location and informed the forest department. Usually they want to see if there is any poaching involved. So
There's poaching up there?
Yeah, I mean, a leopard has a beautiful skin, right? Just like they might poach the elephants for the teeth or the tigers in South for some of the skin. So there also is a potential. So then the forest, I guess, department took the location, came there, like took them a little bit of time to reach that location, very remote. So they did kind of an autopsy and they kind of saw that it was more like a territorial dispute between two male leopards.
This was the one that had died.
Yeah, I could see some damage on the skin. Probably they had been fighting over the territory.
Do they attack any of the humans?
No, it's easier for a leopard to attack like a small goatee compared to a human. As a human, you look looking at a 5-6 feet tall person. They don't know how harmless we are, actually, how unprotected we are, but they probably just assess us by our height, I assume.
You know, it's like we're two humans talking about leopards and we're saying they don't know how harmless we are. I wonder if two leopards also talk about humans like that.
Yeah, <me too.
laughs> they don't know how harmless we are.
Yeah, but they would still, I mean, like we have a reputation at humanity, right? There are also a lot of locals there, I think, who are hunting actually, like bears or wildlife, just for food.
Really?
So yeah, I've seen people in local villages who have guns not to protect, but to hunt and eat, probably because that's what their forefathers used to do.
They eat bear meat?
Yeah, wild meat is usually quite tasty. Even in Belgium, we used to eat wild meat from the forests.
I mean, I've heard of people eating like deer meat.
Deer and so, but anything wild is good. Even my dad used to be a hunter in Belgium. I mean, like pheasants and geese and all that stuff. And the food, I mean, the taste of wild meat is much better than domesticated.
What does it taste like?
Yeah, it tastes much more intense, right? Because these animals have been eating like herbal plants, raw natural things. They are not fed with whatever we feed them in cages. They have been running freely in the wild. So the taste of the meat obviously is also better. Same with shepherds. Why do they take hundreds or thousands of sheep in the meadows to graze the entire snow-fed meadows during the summer? Because the quality of the meat and the milk is much better than what they would have if they grazed them near the village.
So you said like the Bakarwals and all these guys are mostly vegetarian, like once in a while.
That's what I see. I mean, mostly they eat vegetarian foods. I'm sure they can also eat meat, but I think meat is too precious for them. They would rather sell the meat after grazing the animals. And they become big very quick. They multiply also. I told you 50 animals die, but then maybe 200 new sheep get born during 4 months of summer grazing. So they come back with big fat animals. They sell them in the cities. They come to Delhi, to Chandigarh, to Mumbai, probably, the meats, and they are pretty happy, I guess, with vegetarian meals and getting some of the revenue from the herd that they have fed up there.
The meat would be lamb, right?
Lamb, yeah. Lamb, goat and sheep, both two different animals, goat and sheep.
So mutton and lamb.
Mutton and lamb, I guess, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, and the Himalayas are full of that. Between May till September, you go anywhere above the permanent settlements. Anywhere above, say, 3,000 meters, you will not find permanent settlements because there is too much of snow during the winter. But then during the summer, when the snow line goes up to 4,000 or 5,000 meters, all these meadows are full with Bakarwals and shepherds. You can see beautiful. This is like a 1,000 member sheep gang coming down from the Churasi Pass Chamba. This is in Chamba, one of a pass 4,000 meters. I'm standing on a glacier here, which is covered by snow. You can see my Isaacs, which I used to climb up those frozen steep slopes. And there's nobody there. So it's just me, myself, nobody. All of a sudden I hear, bah! Then I look where, and suddenly I see one goatee coming. And then after a while, the entire gang comes down and it's beautiful to see that.
Oh,
look,
wow,
at the meadows.
Oh my God, look at that.
So this is what I'm saying. This is where the shepherds take their animals, say, during summer.
Man.
So this is all covered in snow during winter. And as the summer comes, the snow melts. And these meadows are full of nutritious herbal plants.
And lots of weed.
Weed is also there, like in Malana in some places. And then you can imagine if the animals are feeding on these meadows the entire summer, the quality of the milk and meat is amazing. This is the Pir Panjal, which separates Lahol from Himachal, like a 5,000 meter high rock wall. Very treacherous. I mean, crossing over this as a hiker is one thing, but crossing over this with 1,000 sheep, you can imagine, is a different challenge for the shepherds. You can see all the footsteps of the sheep inside, and it's very steep, very dangerous. You can see a small mandir there, a small colorful flag at the end. So that's a small mandir where the shepherds will thank God for a safe passage, because in case they get stuck here in bad weather at 5,000 meters, then maybe out of 1,000 sheep, 200 sheep might die. They might simply get stuck, fall down, etc.
How do you feel about the mandirs that you come across?
Yeah, I think people there are very religious, say, because they understand the overwhelming force of nature. They understand that we are very small in front of nature, which can be very overwhelming in these high altitude places. If you go to the next slide, you can see some of these mountain tribes. They live in these beautiful wooden mud houses.
Zoom in.
It's a single room. They will cook, they will sleep, and they will have a single room there.
This is in Himachal Pradesh.
This is in Chambaya. So those guys are called Gujars. Gujars are mountain tribes. They live together with their animals. 50% of the house is for humans. 50% of the house is where the small goatees, small buffaloes will stay. They keep them indoors, again, because in the night, predators are out there, which might easily pick up these smaller animals.
Do they ever take children away?
I don't think so. Mostly they go for little children will be safe with the adults inside. And they will have dogs always, dogs to protect whoever is there. So they live very simple. And if you come there as an outsider, they recognize, oh, okay, this guy come. This is the first outsider that I see in my entire life here. So maybe this guy is lost. They get a bit worried on you. They will really take care of you, like, as you feel like a royal guest almost there. They will give you a cup of chai, they will feed you, they will make you a comfortable bed, they will pack up some food the next day, and they will show you the right way to the paths or something. So amazing people.
What food do you eat in Himachal Pradesh?
Mostly like rotis in the evening and rice midday they prepare.
With sabji?
All kinds of sabjis, yeah.
Okay, so, yeah. Gotcha. Can you go to the next slide? Zoom out.
I can hear those beautiful meadows. This is in the Pangi Valley. Pangi is a sub-district of Chamba. It's part of Himachal Pradesh.
What month is this?
This you can see because the meadows are in full bloom. This is in the summer, somewhere in July, August. We're at 4,000 meter altitude here. If you come here, say, beyond September, all the way till May, it'll be completely covered in snow because it's 4,000 meter.
Damn.
So as soon as the snow melts, you get these beautiful colors. And as you go from lower to higher altitude, the colors will change. It's like a rainbow.
Wow.
One flower will flourish at, say, 3,500 meter. You go 200 meter higher, a pink flower comes, then a blue flower, then a red flower. It's like walking on a rainbow. Really beautiful.
Have you ever eaten any of the flowers?
Yeah, so I know a couple of flowers, like in Ladakh, for example. If you run out of water or food, you can help yourself with some of the natural flowers that you know are edible. So I know a couple of flowers there which you could collect. You could cook them into a sabji and survive in case you can run out of food ration.
What does it taste like?
That's pretty good. Sometimes even in the villages, like even in Manali, a touristic place, you can order some of those local fetched plants from the meadows. Tastes just like a vegetable sabji.
Okay, gotcha.
Heck, here you can see those steep rock faces. This is the Marghu Pass in the Pir Panjal, separating Lahore from Chamba, where again some 500-700 sheep come down. Very, very steep. It'll just be like a labyrinth, a small little place where they can come down through these vertical rock faces. Voila, these are the guys, the tribals, like the Gujars, smiling faces like you saw with the kids earlier. They have nothing, they just have a wooden stick, they have a 60 rupee rubber shoe. So we'll come there sometimes with our fancy camping gears and fancy shoes, but these guys, they will easily tame this terrain in very simple. They will have a woolen blanket. And as soon as they see you, you can see a big smiling face. You will try to pass on, but they will be really insisting, no, 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 tonight you stay with us. And they'll start cooking for you and feeding you. They will run off. They will find the goat. They will start milking the goat, prepare tea fresh from the goat. And it'll taste like unlike any tea you taste in
milk, right? Milk
yeah,
will
it's
be
thicker milk. And sometimes if you go with like the Bakarwals who are herding buffaloes, the energy you get from a cup of buffalo milk or tea is like extraordinary. It's like amazing.
Like what, do you feel charged?
Yeah, you feel like the nutrition in buffalo milk is amazing.
Especially at that altitude, it must be creating a lot of heat.
Yeah, indeed. You have been exerting. Like, this is a typical mountain pass. It's like a passage, you can say, from one world to another world. So you cross a mountain range, here the Chobia Pass, connecting Lahore with Chamba Valley. Down there, you can see a massive glacier, a very dangerous one. It's full of crevices, those deep cuts.
Have you ever had a fall or anything in a crevice?
No. So as a solo hiker, it's a bit risky, right? Because in case you fall in a crevice, there is nobody to save you. There is nobody even know that you're stuck somewhere. Usually when you go across a glacier, you will use ropes to rope up. If one of the guys slips inside, the other guys can pull him out. So going solo, and some of these glaciers are covered in snow, which means you don't even see the cuts, the crevices. Crevices are formed by meltwater. So then you use your hiking poles. You have to keep pushing under the snow, whether there is any sudden hole under the snow, a bit tricky, and find a way around it. But yeah, it's interesting. Those glaciers are, again, unique. You'll only find them at 4,500 meter and above. And it's amazing to walk on like an ice sheet, a permanent ice. This has been there for 10,000 years. Imagine permanently frozen snow. It's like 20 kilometer long, 1 kilometer wide. And it's like a different world that you're walking on. It's a world of ice. So really, back here you can see the shepherd getting down the Kukti Pass in Chamba Valley. It's like 1 kilometer of sheep in front of him, because like, it's 1,000 sheep, right? And there is a small little trail. So it's like sometimes 1 or 2 kilometer long. And you can see a dog there, the dog who is going to protect the sheep from like leopards and other predators.
Yeah. I'm having a lot of fun speaking with you.
You should come once to the Himalayas. I can take you for a nice hike.
Happy to. I'm always open to going for hikes. It's when the mountaineers invite me that I get a little scared.
Yeah.
Because I feel like mountaineers are a little bit extreme.
Ropes and stuff. So I keep my feet on the ground, so you don't have to worry. We'll always have both feet on the ground, and gives you a more reassuring feeling.
No, happy to. You know, you're showing me all these photos.
Yeah.
The question that's ringing in my head is about Yetis.
Okay, yeah.
It's actually one of the themes on the show. We keep bringing up the Yeti. How do you feel about the subject?
Yeah, Yetis, I've also heard about it. The big giant, which hasn't been spotted, I guess. I think I saw some article in the news a couple of years ago that the army saw some big footsteps somewhere. I think I've also seen similar things. So what usually happens is when you walk in snow, initially the footprint will just be the size of your foot. But as the snow melts during the day and it freezes during the night, actually the foot can expand so that it looks like a bigger footprint in the snow, and that you might think, oh, some kind of giant has walked across here.
You've seen so much of the mountains, so much of the mountains.
It's beautiful, actually. And imagine if you go for really months altogether, Ranveer. And every day is like a step into the unknown, right? You don't know where you're going to end up. You don't know where you're going to sleep. You don't know whether you're going to find food. You see beautiful pictures of the Sahyadris there.
Mm.
In 2019, I was able to cover 200 forts in just 2 months.
Do you like exploring the Sahyadris as well?
Yeah, Sahyadris are perfect during the winter. So come Gek, this is some of those beautiful water bodies with one of my buddies. The beauty of the Sahyadris is it's naturally, it's beautiful, just like the Himalayas, but you have that rich history, all these like forts out there, and every fort has a story, right, of some conquest. So I've done a lot of mapping and exploration in the Sahyadris also.
How do you feel inside the forts?
Yeah, it gives you something, right? To step on a rock cut, step somewhere that was cut out there like 4 centuries ago. Many of these forts date from the 16th, 17th century, I understand. So it has something magical, actually, that you walk on like a century-old path that was carved out through the forest. And it's a little bit different. Like the geography here is more like volcanic geography. I think Sahyadris were formed there with like some 20 layers of volcanic eruptions. So you get these beautiful like vertical cliffs where the Deccan Plateau drops down into the Konkan foothills.
Mm.
And similar to the Himalayas, so here I used to go with a small backpack for 2 months continuously, and stay during the night in some of these small little hamlets, farming hamlets at the base of the forts. And there again, experiencing really warm hospitality. I still remember at the base of one of the forts where, again, I was trying to just settle down in a small temple in the center of the village. And people actually came to the temple. They picked me up, took them into their house, gave me a bucket of hot water to take a shower after almost a week. And then they insisted after feeding me, there was only one bed there, that I sleep in the bed, and they were sleeping on the floor next to me, which made me feel very guilty. So, I mean, it's really heartwarming. A little bit of technical stuff here in the Sandan Valley. So,
have you ever slipped during your rock climbing sessions?
Yeah, so I've done, like, as I said, some 10,000 kilometers roughly just in the last couple of years itself across the Himalayas. The terrain can be steep and dangerous, but I think before this, I was a bit of an ultra runner. I used to run like 4,000 kilometers every year in the mountains in South. Wow. So I think the legs are pretty strong, and I haven't had any ankle twist or anything. I haven't gone in any 128-hour experience.
Yeah. You're a very interesting man, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, it's you have to realize, I think, two things. One, life is short, number one. And secondly, nature, we live on a very beautiful planet. People don't realize it. So don't really focus too much on career and work until you're old and it's too late. Try to take a break and explore and really experience some of this beautiful nature out there. It's really amazing.
What goes on in your mind when you see all those stars up there?
Yeah, look at this again. It's like beautiful. You see clouds of stars there. Yeah, that's what I told you. When you sleep and it's just you, the campfire and the Milky Way on top of you, you feel like some cosmic connection, actually. I told you I'm not a religious person, but at that moment, you feel like there is something out there. There is some force out there which is bigger than all of us. And I think all of us are connected with some kind of invisible energy. And you can really feel that. I mean, that it's like you're pretty close. You're at 4,000 or 5,000 meters. You see the beautiful stars on top of you, and you kind of feel some connection that you're part of something bigger. It's difficult to explain, but
I understand what you're saying.
You feel some raw energy that you cannot feel here because there is too many layers of human interference there. You're actually in a piece of the planet which has not been touched by the modern human hand, and you can still experience that raw connection with, look at these beautiful pictures at night. Wow. With the stars on top of you. And yeah, I mean, life in the wild is something that everybody should experience. I think it's a must. You can see some of the forts in the Sahyadris. You can see the guys with the AK-47. So 2022, I did some 1,000 kilometers in Jammu. So Himachal, Ladakh, Uttarakhand, all fine. But as soon as you come towards JNK, I would have ended up in, this is like 2 months, I would have ended up some 10 times either in a police station or in an army check post. And all friendly people, but yeah, it's a bit kind of difficult, right? You're in a 100-kilometer traverse, and then some shepherd will say, there is a foreigner here. I mean, not a foreigner, an outsider here roaming around. Hey, what is this guy doing here? And then they pick you up and they take you to a police station 5 hours down the valley. So you lose the momentum.
Mm. This whole episode has been about getting to understand what the human mind and body are actually meant to do.
Yeah.
We're meant to be out in nature. That's how our bodies have evolved, to be hunter-gatherers, to be nomadic.
Yeah.
That's it. That's today's episode, Peter. Any message for all the people watching this completely fascinated by your reality?
Yeah, I would say take a break sometimes, guys. Don't be too much focused. Keep a life-work balance. Sometimes take a break and please come join me in the Himalayas. I also teach twice a year, like in Manali. A one-week course. You're welcome to join my Alpine Field Boot Camp, where I can teach you some of these survival skills, map reading, navigation skills, so that you can also pick up a bag and head out into the wild.
And spot some Yetis, maybe.
Yeah, maybe find the Yeti, the elusive Yeti.
Peter Van Giet, thank you. Appreciate your time, appreciate your presence.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Ranveer.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.
Yeah.
That was the episode for today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm always looking out for guests like this who are slightly alternate. I'm always looking for guests who have something fresh to bring to the table. I do believe that the Indian podcast space is booming, but I also believe that people are not reinventing the space. People are only bringing the same kind of conversations, which is the thinking behind this particular episode or episodes like this in general. It's such a breath of fresh air, right? So tell me what you thought of this one. Do suggest guests like these if you know people like this within the realms of India. And please tell me what you thought of today's conversation. Share it with all your friends. Peter Van Geet will be back on TRS. Ranveer and the whole team will also return with another fresh perspective very, very soon. Lots of love. Keep supporting The Ranveer Show.